Thank you so much, Ray. Ray's over there praising Chris, right? Yeah, it's great. I know he was. We're blessed. No offense. Okay. No, good. Good. I'm a former nurse. I can't control myself. Anybody want to spray? I'm good. Okay. All right. So, thank you. After that beautiful song, wow, it's hard to know what to say because that just so sums up what is going on in the world right now. Everybody's poking at each other, right? Everybody's poking at each other. You know, I keep thinking that we're going through like the five stages of grief with this pandemic. First was denial. Anybody here denial? Yeah, you know, oh, we'll get this down pat in like 6 weeks. Not so much. It's still going on, isn't it? And now there seems to be a lot of anger going on. So hopefully at some point that will come to acceptance. We're certainly working on it in this center of helping people express their feelings, but also move to a higher level of consciousness, a higher vibration that actually creates the reality that we really want, not only for ourselves, but for all beings everywhere. And so today I'm talking about that sort of abstractly because one of the challenges that we have as human beings is that we identify with things that do not serve us. We over-identify with things that do not serve our spiritual side. So the talk this morning is a case of mistaken identity. A case of mistaken identity. I'm not sure where that phrase is from, but it's very familiar. Probably from some cop show or something that I watch, but when I think of mistaken identity, my mind automatically flashed back to this essay that I read probably like 10 years ago. It's an essay by David Sedaris, who is a humorist. He's a comedic writer, very very funny. He writes a lot about growing up gay in North Carolina, which just I love it because I lived in North Carolina for such a long time, and it was in the 60s too, so it was a very different place back then. But anyway, in this particular essay, he writes about how his father accused the whole family of stealing something from the father's drawer. But it was a bunch of coins. And when David decided to figure out who had done that, and so because the family was watching that old TV show from the 60s, remember The Fugitive? With David Janssen, and in the beginning, there's this big monologue in the beginning about David Janssen's fate, that he watched somebody murder his wife, or his wife got murdered, and a one-armed man was running from the scene, and he had to catch him, and he escaped from the train on the way to death row, and he changed his identity. He changed his identity, and David Sedaris said that his memory of Richard Kimball changing his identity was a quick shot of a bottle of shoe polish on the sink. And so David, it's not really shoe polish, I looked at the opening and it's actually hair dye, but anyway, David Sedaris thought it was shoe polish and he decided that he was gonna change his identity and spy on the person that has taken his father's coins because the whole family was in trouble. So he got shoe polish and he put it all over his hair. And he said it was like a shoe polish helmet, and how, you know, Richard Kimball's hair like flows in the breeze. David's hair wasn't going anywhere. But anyway, he climbed into his father's closet that had sort of like these like slats that you could look through, and he watched and he spied to see who was going through his father's drawers. Well, it was pretty much the whole family, but in the end, he discovered that his mother had done it, and I think she ultimately confessed. This is after, you know, an hour of being in the closet with his shoe polish on his head. He said he was practically passing out from the fumes. And then he got out of the closet, went about his life, washed off the shoe polish, and his father was happy until he went into his closet and saw black stains all over his Dacron polyester leisure suits. No doubt about who did that, right? Anyway, what I love about that story is that to me, everything seems like a metaphor, and that story is no exception. It seems like a metaphor of how, you know, we are the divine. We are everything that Eckhart Tolle said. We are the beingness. We are the I am. We are not I am this, I am that. We just are I am. And yet, we pile a bunch of stuff on ourselves, shoe polish, metaphorical shoe polish, which might be stories or limitations like Bill talked about in his message. And we throw ourselves in a closet, you know, and I think Jesus said it really well. Jesus said it really well when he said, don't hide your light under a bushel. That means don't hide your I am presence under a bushel. Let it shine. Let it come forth. But the thing is that when we have these identities that we impose upon ourselves, not only do we impose these identities on ourselves, is that we believe them. We identify with them, and again, the reading from Eckhart Tolle said is that to identify means to make the same. So we think, I am that. I am my stories. I am my limitations. I am my frailties. I am my dilemmas. I am my problems. And we think that about the world, too. We project that outward. You are all of the things that I just said, and so much more. We do this all the time. So this message this morning is about providing an alternative to that type of consciousness. This type of consciousness is not mandatory. We are not saddled with it. We pick it up just through race consciousness and we hold on to it, but we can let it go. We can let it go at any time simply by learning to refrain from over-identifying with the identities that we assume, and at some point, perhaps not even assuming any other identity than I am. So I hope you're with me on this, because imagine the world if we all did that. How beautiful that would be. I want to talk a little bit about God. Surprise! So, I know that we have some newer folks probably watching on the live stream, and in this center, we teach that God is not a person, it is more of a presence, and even more so, it is a principle. That God is the energy of love, and that God is the energy of science, that everything is love, and that God is this beautiful energy that infuses everything, that life was created out of God. God created life out of itself. I like it when the non-dualists refer to God as consciousness or awareness, because awareness and consciousness seems something more personal and something that is perhaps more relatable. We do get stuck in the understanding that awareness is everything, that everything emerges out of awareness, but at least calling it awareness or absolute reality or consciousness helps us get a start on that, helps us get a handle on that. When I want to learn more about non-duality, I have a number of teachers that I turn to, including Ernest Holmes, the founder of this religion, but yesterday I decided to listen to a podcast, or a video rather, or YouTube, about from Rupert Spira about identity. And he phrased it in a way that was slightly different than I would have normally thought, so I'm actually going to read kind of the highlights of what he said. He said that awareness, in terms of identity, the true identity of everything is awareness. Awareness is the identity of everything. And remember that identity means the same or identical to. So a horse, a butterfly, a wave in the ocean, a plant in the garden, a human, we all are made out of the same basic non-material material. And what we do as humans is that we tend to make identity exclusive. This is me, that is you. This is me, that is a horse. This is me, that is a door or a building. We tend to make identity exclusive. However, awareness is always one with the totality of experience and being. Awareness is always one with the totality of experience and being. That means that I am, you are, is always one with the totality of experience and being. And if we really believe that, if we really take that in, if we continue to remind ourselves of that truth, then we will start living like that truth is true, because it is true. and how wonderful life is when we start to recognize that identity is the same, is all of experience and all of being, that we are the I am, and so is everything else. Can you feel that with me? Can you feel that that's a good thing? That's exciting? Thank you, Ray and Lori. That's awesome. Thank you, everybody else, too. It's wonderful to think of ourselves as the I am presence. It's both humbling and enlarging at the same time, which to me is a sign that we're on the right track, when you feel humbled by it and also enlarged by it. The question is, though, in our day-to-day lives, you know, we often are caught up in the thinking of the world or the thinking of our families or the thinking of the voices in our heads. How do we move past that tendency to identify with something small when instead we can identify with all that is? Here's another metaphor. It's a little strange at first, but work with me. We'll get there, okay? I'm going to need the basket of wisdom in just a moment, so prepare yourself. The basket of, well, I'll tell you. I put Facebook posts, questions on Facebook, and I asked people to answer questions. And one of the first questions I asked yesterday was, what kind of lunchbox did you have as a child? Oh my gosh, I was shocked at how that blew up. Everybody wanted to tell me about their lunchbox or their non-lunchbox. It was beautiful. Everybody wanted to engage. Maybe it's like a cast back to a more innocent time when we were carrying lunchboxes and not worrying about this stupid pandemic, you know? That back when things were a lot simpler when we were younger. So I'm gonna pull out some responses of the types of lunchboxes that we have. And now it is time for the basket of wisdom to make its appearance on stage. If you could sing the theme to Jaws at home, that would be great. Dun, 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 dun. Thank you. Oops, one fell on the ground. Three fell on the ground. Okay. All right, here we go. Yeah, good job, Chris. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, here we go. All right. I love spraying stuff. You have no idea. Let's see. I don't know if the blue ones are the first question or the second ones. Okay, so I'm going to pick out three lunch boxes. One, two, and three. And I'll put these over here for now. Okay, three lunch boxes. Karen, brown paper bag. Chip, Tom Corbett, space cadet. Now, space cadet means like a person who goes into space, right? It's not just like somebody like, oh my God, I'm so spacey, right? I'm thinking that's what that is. Okay, and then we have another brown paper bag. I need to pick another one. That was Barb's brown paper bag. I'm gonna pick another one. And then I'll tell you who the all-time winner of lunchboxes was. Dina had a vinyl flowered lunchbox with a long strap. Is that not sassy or what? The biggest occupant of lunchboxes was Scooby-Doo. We got more Scooby-Doos than anybody else. Mine was Zorro, you know. Was Zorro your first crush too? Yeah, he's the first bad boy that I fell in love with, and that's been a pattern like my whole life. Hello. So, sorry. So, anyway. So, I asked about the lunchbox because it's a container for something, just like we are the container for something. And, you know, lunchboxes can have a lot of stuff attached to them. Like, people were saying that they were teased about their lunchboxes. If they just had Tupperware, they were teased about their lunchbox. We were also teased about the content of our lunchbox, or devastated by the content of our lunchbox. If you didn't have something that was good to trade, that wasn't so good. Somebody said they had a stinky peanut butter sandwich and a stinky banana, not so good. I remember the fatal day when my mother sent me a sardine sandwich to lunch. I'd never even seen a sardine. I'm like, what are these fish doing on this bread? What do I do with this? It was crazy. And I didn't eat it because I was a little scared of it. So, but anyway, my point is that if we look deeper, we see deeper. If we look deeper, let's say most people had sandwiches in their lunchbox, right? Let's say we're just looking at a piece of bread that's a sandwich. So it's a piece of bread, but is it really a piece of bread? Is it not really something that's infinite? we identify a piece of bread as this is a piece of bread. This is its limitations. It's a piece of bread. You can only do certain things with it. But a piece of bread is also the sunshine. Yes. And it's also the wheat that was grown. Yes. And it's the soil that I told you about a couple weeks ago, that in one teaspoon of soil, there are more microorganisms than there are people on Earth. And all of that conspired together to create this plant that created bread. It is the hands that manage the seeds or put them in the ground or drove the tractor or the thresher or whatever, however it is you harvest wheat. It is the people that baked it. It is the other ingredients in the bread. And we could go on and on and on and on to the cellular level to know that the bread is of the earth, and that because it's of the earth, it is of the divine. And every single thing that we find in our lunchbox or in anything else or inside of ourselves, if we choose to see deeper, then we can release our identification with it or our identification of it as something mundane and something plain and recognize that it is truly divine. Do you feel that about the bread? That bread is not what we thought it was? Bread is awesome. Bread is incredible. Like I said, it's the sunlight and the rain and the soil. How beautiful is that? And as we get really good about doing that about the things in our lives, we can start seeing deeper into our own hearts. This thing that I've been struggling with, what is the deeper view of this? What is the deeper view of my fear in this situation? You know, what is the deeper view of this virus? Is it just a virus that is creating some very strange changes in our lives? Or is it something else? Is it something to wake us up to a greater reality? Is the virus part of the divine? You know, I wrote a piece the other day about wearing masks, about how wearing masks can be seen as a limitation, but we do it, of course, to protect ourselves and to protect others. My objection to wearing masks is not about having to wear one or not being able to breathe, like I hear from some folks. It's more about that people can't know that I like them. You know, when I'm in the grocery store, I want people to know that I'm happy with them and that I'm with them. And so because of the mask, because of the constraint, I started getting more creative in my approach to people and started starting conversations about all kinds of things, conversations about eyelashes. You know, there's a woman in Vons who has these amazing eyelashes, and I asked her, how do you do that? Because I'm getting better because of her, but this one is still trying to get away. I can feel it right now. It's liable to drop off and land on the floor like some kind of a bug. So... So you see that we tend to over-identify with limitations, whether they're personal limitations or the limitations that seem to be around us. But beyond the limitations, if we're willing to see deeper and say, you know, this limitation is really creativity in disguise. How can I do things differently? That's right. And then that changes everything. Because I guarantee that if we ask questions like that, rather than just identifying with it and going down our path of identity, if we step back from the identity and see something a little bit differently and ask to see it differently, even if we don't know the answer, if we ask to see it deeper, something will be provided for us. We don't necessarily know what it is. It may not make any sense, but I suggest asking and doing and living like the truth of our asking is true. The other thing that I think helps us release our identification, I just said it a moment ago, it's seeing deeper, but it's also seeing broader, stepping back. I was on a call the other day, a book club that I do with people from all over the world, and we were actually reading the Eckhart Tolle book that Hugh quoted, A New Earth. And one of the women, I don't remember which one, talked about how she had this dream where she was in an apartment building. And then she went outside, and the whole front of the apartment building was transparent. So she thought it was just her in her apartment, but when she saw the apartment, that there was all this activity going on in every single apartment. And she said, the reality in 12B is just as real as the reality in 14C. But when we're in 14C, we don't even think about 12B. But if we step back, we can see that there are all of these realities. And really, the choice is ours. If we are in a little room, in my Father's house, there are many mansions, right? Did I get that right? Okay. In my Father's house, there are many mansions. if we're in one particular mansion that is not providing us with productive ideas or creativity or love or whatever it is we need to do to bless ourselves and to bless others, we can just change rooms because the other rooms are there even if we don't see it. But in the dream, it took her stepping outside of ourselves, stepping back and looking for the transparency and seeing what could be seen when she changed her vision just a little bit. So that's an option for us as well, to do that. Whatever that means for you metaphorically, look at a place where you're looking at something too closely, over-identifying with it, and say, what happens if I step back and give this a broader view, a deeper view, a broader view and a deeper view? And same thing, we can ask Spirit, God, Beloved, please give me a broader view of this situation, right? Same thing, you know, what I talked before about COVID, about politics, about everything that's going on. If we step back in a broader view, maybe it makes a little bit more sense when we do that. Maybe there's a little bit more forgiveness. Maybe there's a little bit more grace that is trying to emerge. And yet if we're pounding on it and identifying others with right and wrong, it's not Rumi's field. We got to move past the ideas of wrongdoing and right doing and have that broader view. That Rumi's field becomes a meadow. Rumi's field becomes a football field. Rumi's field becomes 10 football fields all strewn together. Rumi's field is the earth and Rumi's field is the universe. If we can do that, there's great hope for all of us, both individually and collectively. The last thing I want to say about identification and over-identifying, perhaps, is to surrender everything. We see deeply, we see broadly, and we surrender everything. Now, this doesn't mean that you have to give up all your stuff. I know that when I talk with this about dog lovers, they say, do I have to give up my dog? And I say, absolutely not. That would be wrong. No. Just means surrender. Surrender your ideas. Surrender your grasping. Surrender your clinging. I asked, that was my second question on Facebook. I'm going to read some responses in just a minute. I asked, what are you clinging to? It was interesting because I was expecting a very different type of response. I thought people would be like me, of course, because I was saying, well, I actually not so much right now, but I was clinging to sugar. I was clinging to various other addictive activities like doing like computer games. I was clinging to the clinging to the need to know how this is all going to turn out. That did not serve me very well. As soon as I moved into acceptance, things got better. But I got some sort of different responses that puzzled me a bit. So I'm going to see, maybe I'll get one of those, maybe I won't. Let's see. I'm going to pull out three responses. Okay, three responses from the Basket of Wisdom. Gina is clinging to her friends. Stephanie is clinging to hope. Kathy, oh, we're twins. She's clinging to having to know all the answers. The biggest, like Scooby-Doo, was the most popular answer on the lunchbox question. Hope was the biggest, the most popular response on what are you clinging to? And I said to myself, wow, are you going to go into church on Sunday and tell people that they shouldn't cling to hope? Isn't that like the opposite? Like we're supposed to have hope, we're supposed to have faith, we're supposed to trust in God and tether our camel? And I was really puzzled about this. I went to bed puzzled about what I was going to say. But I do know, I've learned from some of my Buddhist friends, that the object that we're clinging to is not as important as the clinging itself. The clinging itself is what gets us in trouble. And if we are clinging to something with white knuckles, chances are we're holding on to it too tightly and we're resisting anything else. We're resisting it going away. And that often creates issues with our lives and with our identity, and we don't have the same resonance and connection with the I Am presence that we do when we're clinging to something. But rather than tell people to give up hope, to stop clinging to hope, I went to bed, like I said, puzzled, and I woke up in the middle of the night, as I often do, and it was dark, and I just had this download of what I wanted to say, and I wrote it in the dark. Could barely read it in the morning, but I'm going to read it to you now because I transcribed it. Okay, so it says, don't let go of hope. Become hope. Allow both hope and hopelessness, and rest in the tension of opposites without clinging or resisting either one. Your equanimity, your ability to tolerate paradox, will allow you to rise out of the opposites and be the source of all things. This is where your hope abides. This is true hope, the hope beyond hope. And the good news is for all of us, is that we are already that. All it takes is a release of mistaken identity. So take off the shoe polish, come out of the closet, and be who you really are. You are the I Am Presence, living and expressing as you. And so it is. Namaste. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, everybody. Thanks. I hope you all are clapping at home because, you know, God's watching. Kidding. Chris, I guess it's time to pray. Yes, it's time to do the prayer.